Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's snowing out there. It's not too heavy yet, but the roads are slick and slippery. So wherever you go, drive carefully and take 94 WIP with you. Always hot conversation if you get stuck in traffic and all the day long. When we come back in just a bit, one of the most popular New Year's resolutions is lose weight. You need to lose weight? Well, lift up that T-shirt, open up the pajama top, check out what's going on underneath the nightgown. Too fat? Well, maybe my guest has something to say to you. When we come back in just a bit, Dr. Juan Rivera, he's creator of the Mojito Diet. Mojitos, whoa. All this and more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back. It's conversation. My conversation this morning with Dr. Juan Rivera, creator of the Mojito Diet. My name's Peter Solomon. Good morning, Dr. Rivera.
How are you, Peter?
I'm fine. Is America too fat?
Absolutely. We know that by statistics, more than 60% of Americans are either overweight or obese.
How'd we get there?
I think basically it relates to what we eat. In this country, we eat a lot of processed food. Everything that we do, whether it's a business meeting, whether it's going out with friends or family, it's around food. No one says, meet me at the park so we can walk for 15 or 20 minutes. It's, let's go to breakfast, let's go to lunch, or let's meet for dinner. Everything in our country is related with food. And most of the time, unfortunately, it's not healthy food.
Meeting for food is not necessarily a bad thing. You just said it yourself.
Absolutely. I don't think that meeting for food is it's wrong. It's just that everything we do can't be associated or related with food. There's nothing wrong with taking a meeting and going to the park and walking, or going to the gym with a friend. There's definitely nothing wrong with obviously having dinner or having lunch. It's just that we cannot have an obsession about food. In other words, we should eat to live and not live to eat.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. Now, breakfast. You mentioned lunch and dinner, but you haven't mentioned breakfast.
I know. And the reason why I haven't mentioned breakfast is because in the past, I would say 10 years, there's a lot of evidence that has been published with regards to something called intermittent fasting, which is a plan that I include in my diet during the second week of my diet. And during intermittent fasting, what we ask people is to stop eating at 8 p.m. and then resume eating at 12 p.m. the next day. So during those 16 hours, in the book I call it a clean 16 fast. During those 16 hours, basically you can drink coffee, black coffee, you can drink water, you can drink tea. And studies have shown that intermittent fasting is good for weight loss, is good for decreasing insulin resistance, which basically means it's good for glucose or sugar control. It's good for controlling blood pressure. And some preliminary studies show that it can be actually good to prevent dementia.
But Mama said breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
I know. I think that for many, many years, we have been following that idea that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. But breakfast relates to breaking fast. It doesn't matter if you do it at 8 a.m. or 10 a.m. or 2 p.m. What I'm saying here is that if we stay fasting for 16 hours, and then you can basically eat your breakfast at 12 p.m., then studies have shown that it's better than having breakfast, let's say, at 8 a.m. when you have slept for 8 hours. And it's actually also better than eating every 3 hours, as some diets would have you do.
But you wake up, very often you're going to be hungry, and if you have to wait till noon to eat, You're going to eat the kitchen.
I know. Listen, a lot of people feel intimidated by this concept of intermittent fasting, and it's not that difficult. You get used to it very quickly. Out of those 16 hours, you're sleeping for about 8 hours, hopefully, because that is important for your health. And then the other 8 hours, you can drink your coffee. I know a lot of people want to drink coffee, and coffee is healthy. As long as you drink black coffee, you're okay. And one of the things that I include in my book, it's a recipe for something called the mojito water. And that's just water, and I add some mint and lime. And mint and lime have shown to soothe your stomach, help you with the hunger during those 8 hours or 6 hours. It's very doable, Peter. Very, very doable.
And too often, though, when we do have breakfast, it's carbohydrates, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I include in the diet, so the first week of my diet, it's a grain drop or basically a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet. So it's not only that we eat carbohydrates, Peter, it's that we eat the wrong carbohydrates. So a lot of us, and I include myself, because for many years, my diet was a typical American diet, mixed, I would say, with my Latin or Hispanic background, which was a lot of white rice, which was a lot of white bread, pasta, definitely the wrong carbohydrates. That increases your belly fat. It increases your risk of having prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. And obviously once, let's say you're a 42-inch waist and you definitely have that belly fat, that increases inflammation in your body, which can lead to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease as well.
So no more bagels, no more donuts.
No, we have to concentrate on good carbohydrates. During the second week of my diet, I include good carbohydrates such as sweet potato. You can eat whole wheat bread. You can eat quinoa. They're better choices.
Absolutely. How about for lunch and dinner?
So for lunch and dinner, basically, I'm going to tell you the way that I do it, which to me seems easy. For lunch, I concentrate on having a good protein, whether it's salmon or whether it is chicken, turkey, and I'm going to eat it with a salad. No dressing, obviously, because dressing is processed and it has a lot of sodium. And so a good protein with salad, it's good for lunch. As a snack, almonds are good. That's good fat. And we know that there's a big difference between good fat and bad fat. Good fat is good for your triglycerides. It decreases your cardiovascular risk. And bad fat obviously increases your cardiovascular risk. What is bad fat? Obviously red meat, for example. And then for dinner, you know, again, you want to include a good protein. In my diet, I don't eliminate completely red meat. You can do it in moderation, especially if it's lean. And you can do something like quinoa and always vegetables, always vegetables.
Now, the salad intrigues me a little bit, too, because if God wanted me to eat salad without dressing, he would have made me a rabbit. low-calorie dressing, isn't okay?
Say that again?
Low-calorie dressing, does that work?
Yeah, listen, I think that the most important thing with the dressing is look at the nutritional information and look at the sodium. We ingest so much sodium in this country. For example, the American Heart Association want us to consume less than 2,000 milligrams of sodium. It is extremely difficult to do that when you're going to the supermarket and getting your food. Everything has so much sodium. So if you find a very low sodium one, then you can try it. But especially for people with hypertension and congestive heart failure, they really, really need to be paying attention to this.
Okay. No sugar, though? Not even in the coffee?
So my recommendation for sugar would be, if you can, no sugar. Now, let me tell you, I'm the first one that can't do that. So what I do is I use stevia or truvia because those are plant-based sweeteners. I wouldn't use a chemical one.
So don't use the red, pink, or blue.
Yeah, I would. I would definitely stay with the plant derived or plant based ones. The problem with the sugar or some of the artificial sweeteners, Peter, is that they increase your insulin as well, the same way that sugar does. And when insulin goes up in our body, that's an anabolic hormone, and that's what makes us gain weight.
Is it different for men than it is for women?
So, yes, there are several things that are different for men and women. So, for example, I can tell you then that when men and women do my diet, men are going to lose weight faster. You know, what I've seen in the 2 weeks, in the first 2 weeks of the diet, men tend to lose between, I would say, 9 and 15 pounds, depending on how loyal they are to the diet. Women are going to lose maybe between 6 and 10 pounds. With women, obviously, if they, you know, there's hormonal changes that play a role in terms of how quickly they're going to lose the weight. What I can tell you is that eventually they catch up. So nothing to be worried about. But I think that the first difference that I would mention is that, and I think all doctors know this, women tend to lose weight a little bit slower, and it annoys them. But don't worry, because you guys can catch up relatively quickly.
Does it vary among ethnicities?
You know, it's interesting. Let me take Hispanic for a moment, just because that's my background. If you look at Hispanics living in Latin America, whether it's Guatemala or any of the Latin American countries, their numbers in terms of cholesterol and blood sugar, and I would say Mexico would be the exception, but let's take other countries in Central America. Their values are better than ours. And when they come to the United States, when they migrate to the United States, and they adopt an American diet, their indicators go south. All of a sudden, the cholesterol goes up, their blood sugar goes up. And I think the difference is people in some of those countries are literally eating fresh food. They get it in the market, or they get it at the market every day. And cook a lot more than what we do in the United States. I have patients, Peter, that have dinner at a restaurant every night. So imagine the salt and the sugar that they're consuming just by eating out at a restaurant every night. I have patients of mine that say, well, but I go to a good restaurant and I eat healthy. And I said, well, the main goal of that restaurant is for your food to taste really, really good. And that usually, it's going to mean a lot of salt, a lot of sugar. So we tend to cook less, and we tend to eat a lot more processed food.
Well, isn't part of the problem, or is part of the problem, America, the land of fast food?
Absolutely. There's several problems when it comes to that. You know, on my show, Peter, I give a lot of advice to Hispanics about eating and nutrition. But no matter how many times, Peter, I tell them, you need to snack on strawberries, you need to snack on blueberries. When some of these families actually go and try to buy the strawberries that I told them to buy on the show, they can't afford it. And so they have 3 kids. They don't have the means to buy healthy food. And guess what? Their only choice is the fast food. So that's a big problem that we have. I feel like we educate. In my case, I educate my audience constantly. But there are barriers that prevent them from doing the right thing.
What do you recommend to them?
You know, what I recommend to them is basically try to cook at home as much as you can, as much as you can. Make it a family thing. Try to include vegetables with everything, everything. With, you know, if you're doing intermittent fasting, then obviously with your lunch, with your dinner. Do activities at home. I mean, kids nowadays are constantly playing video games. I have a 14-year-old. I have to drag him out of the room to go and play basketball outside, to go and kick a soccer ball outside. It's important that we stay active. That doesn't require, you know, $4 or $5 of strawberries, right? That just requires enthusiasm and the willpower to do it. And then, you know, I do teach them how to make healthy choices. Instead of buying the white bread, buy the whole wheat bread. Instead of eating rice, try to eat quinoa. There's small changes that they can make. For example, try to drink water. Forget the soda. You know, step by step, you can make some good changes.
And you alluded to something that's important. Children watch what their parents do. So you have to be careful not to preach good food to your children as you wolf down a fast food burger.
Absolutely. I would say that we have to lead by example. Doesn't mean that we're not going to enjoy once in a while a pizza with our kids. They're still kids. So I hate the concept of a diet for kids. I honestly don't like that. My 14-year-old, for example, it drives me nuts that when I am sitting with him, let's say, having lunch and he's having French fries, the amount of ketchup that he uses drives me nuts. But I'm not going to make our lunch experience a bad one just because it annoys me how much ketchup he eats. But I am going to mention something, and I'm constantly telling him what he should do. And my hope is that when, you know, he's 18 or maybe 21 or maybe 25, I don't know, he'll remember everything that I told him.
Well, I have seen ketchup without sugar. And in terms of vegetables and pizza, there's a trend in pizza now to make part of the crust with cauliflower.
Yes, I've had that, and it's actually delicious.
So that's important. And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Dr. Juan Rivera. He's a cardiologist down there in Miami, and he's got a new book, The Mojito Diet. Dr. Rivera, what makes your diet different than other diets? I mean, we walk into the bookstore, and there's a gazillion books on diet. Why would I pick yours?
So obviously the title catches everyone's attention, and let me explain it to you. So basically for years, as a cardiovascular prevention doctor, I've been helping people to lose weight. And one of the things that I noticed that people are not willing to do, Peter, or at least a lot of people in Miami, is stop their social drinking. And as a physician, you have two options. You can fire them from your clinic because they don't want to stop drinking to lose weight, or you can do what a lot of doctors do and I do, which is you negotiate with them. So for many years, I've been telling people, okay, you want to have your mojito, or you want to have your wine, or you want to have your vodka, then what I need you to do is you have to limit it to 2 drinks a week as opposed to 1 a day, and then you're going to follow this diet, and together we're going to accomplish something here. So the mojitos in my book, it's basically a reward. It's a reward for doing the right thing. And I do believe that diets should be about celebrating life, celebrating getting healthy. It should not feel like a prison. And you should be able to continue enjoying your social life and your family and your friends. If you don't drink, fantastic. You don't have to. You can actually change the 2 mojitos a week for a 300-calorie dessert. I'm okay with that. But if you drink, let me tell you, doing it every day is not going to help you lose weight. It's not. And in some instances, it's a slippery slope to actually drinking more, which is detrimental to your health. So this is a negotiation between me and my patients, and hopefully now between me and a lot of other people. The diet itself is very simple. It's 14 days. The first week, you're basically doing a grain drop, as I told you before. And then the second week, I'm asking patients to do a 16-hour intermittent fasting, 3 days out of the 7 days. Obviously, there's going to be people out there that need to lose more than 10 to 14 pounds. And what I tell them to do is to keep alternating between week one and week two until they achieve goal. So I think to answer your question directly, I think this is a very realistic diet. This is a diet that you can follow, a lifestyle that you can follow for the rest of your life. A lot of the diets out there, Peter, are going to, for example, eliminate a whole food group, or eliminate carbohydrates forever, or never eat tomatoes, and never eat bread. I think those are the diets that people do. They lose weight for a month or two, and then they basically can't tolerate continuing to do it. And that's when trouble begins.
Because people hear diet and think deprivation.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you see diets that basically tell you to eat 500 calories a day. What is that? I mean, that's not even healthy. Who can tolerate that? I mean, the best example, Peter, is, I don't know if you guys remember the show The Biggest Loser.
Mm-hmm.
So in The Biggest Loser, people were dropping weight extremely quickly. It was a very extreme diet. Well, there's a study that was published, I think, in the past 2 years, more or less. And they looked at the first contestants of the first season, 17 individuals. Well, after 16, 17 years, 16 out of the 17 weigh more than when they started the show.
Mm.
So you have to follow a lifestyle, and by the way, an exercise routine that is realistic, that you like it. Otherwise, it just becomes very difficult.
Is exercise an important piece of the equation in the Mojito diet?
You know, I say for everyone who is trying to lose weight, diet is going to be about 70% of the equation. 30% of the equation would be activity. What I tell people in my book is that I want them to do something they like. I always say, Peter, if you ask 1,000 Latinos to run a marathon at 5 a.m., 999 are not going to show up. I'm going to be one of those. But if you tell them that there's a salsa dancing marathon at 5 p.m., 999 will show up. So you have to do something you like, whether it's dancing, whether it's playing tennis, whether it's cycling, whether it's jogging, walking outside, you need to find out what motivates you. What do you like? Because that is what's going to be sustainable.
Absolutely. What about people who argue, I'm fat because of the fat gene? It runs in my family. All of my family are fat.
Well, listen, there is some to that, but I don't believe that genes define us. There's a lot of environmental factors that play a role. For example, I would tell that individual, okay, well, let's study your situation. Let me see how many calories you're ingesting a day. How many times are you eating at a fast food restaurant? How much exercise are you doing? Are you sleeping okay? Are you sleeping your 8 hours? There's so many factors out there, risk factors, that contribute to obesity, that for someone to convince me that it is because of genetics, you know, it would be rare.
Okay.
The same thing, the same argument, Peter, with hypothyroidism. You see people that are 50 pounds overweight, and they'll be, well, it's my thyroid. Well, you know what? People who have hypothyroidism, yes, they can gain weight, but it's usually 10 to 15 pounds. Because of the thyroid problem, it's not 60 pounds.
I wonder sometimes if people who use things like hypothyroidism or the fat gene so they don't have to blame themselves.
Let me tell you, my grandmother, bless her soul, passed away, 6-7 years ago, she did that all the time. I kept telling her, abuela, you know, grandmother, you need to lose weight, you need to lose weight. Oh, it's my thyroid. And in the meantime, I could see her snacking pattern, and it was horrible.
Amen to that. I know the feeling, and I know the grandmother type. And you're listening to Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. We'll be back with Dr. Juan Rivera, author of The Mojito Diet, in just a bit. The WIP time, 6:28. And we're back here on Conversation with Dr. Juan Rivera, author of The Mojito Diet. My name's Peter Solomon. Dr. Rivera, we have a question from one of our listeners. You mentioned tomatoes as being not a good thing. Why is that?
What I mentioned was that there are some diets that will eliminate forever foods or groups of food, whether we're talking about carbohydrates or whether we're talking about tomatoes. I was just making an example of that. In other words, I don't believe that eliminating something forever, except if we're talking about ice cream, probably, it's a good idea.
All right, now.
So in the mojito diet, you can definitely eat tomatoes. That was just an example I was using of other diets, perhaps, that want to eliminate something forever.
Let's see if we got the question answered then by Jerry of Darby. Jerry, your question or comment, please.
Yeah, that's that. Hey, Dr. Juan, listen, I'm a devout listener of Peter's, and you know what I mean? And I find you most fascinating because we fast in our faith, you know what I mean? And I'm an ex-fighter by trade, stonemason. And what you said about the blueberries and strawberries, I always push them, you know what I mean, in my diet with egg whites for strength and size. But I have a problem with tomatoes where I can't consume enough. I mean, I love use pasta and stuff like that. But the biggest killer for me is, like I was having breakfast after a funeral yesterday with Reverend Father, and he said, Jared, take it easy on that tomato juice. And it rung a bell when I heard you say tomatoes. You speaking about sodium, is tomato juice loaded with sodium?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I would say kudos to you on the strawberries and the blueberries. Those to me are actually the best fruits to eat. And as a matter of fact, especially blueberries, studies have shown that they can decrease the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. So that's a good choice right there. I don't have a problem with fresh tomatoes. I really don't. I mean, I think that they're healthy. Now, you have a point. When you are talking about tomato juice, you definitely have to check how much sodium you're taking in, because some of these products are going to be processed. If they are on a shelf for a long, long time, have to be for a long, long time, that means that they're probably processed, and you definitely don't want to do that. So if you see something that has, you know, hundreds of milligrams of sodium, not very good for you. So the first thing I would do is I would check that nutrition label right away. And if the sodium content is high, I would try to give them up.
Okay. So in other words, what I can take from this is make my own. You know, I have the ingredients. I have a blender. Throw a little celery in there, you know what I mean, for flavor.
Absolutely.
That will work, right? You know,
absolutely.
Because I try to stay away from all salts, you know, because of my weight problem. I was a middleweight, man, and I'm a super heavyweight now. I'm 63, and I noticed, like, that my times in walking, the distances I used to walk, I'm all in for that fast that you're talking about. I mean, it makes total sense to me. Being disciplined and regimented as a boxer in my youth, you know what I mean? I think that that's obtainable for me. And the thing that I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned lime to settle my stomach. I love lime. I buy that product, Fuji Water. and I squeeze up lime juice and lemon juice and mix that in, you know what I mean? Like a shot of each, you know what I mean? A shot glass of each. Will that actually help me with my stomach problems, or will that be good for me?
Absolutely. I think especially if you're doing intermittent fasting, in my book, I add something called the mojito water that basically includes,
yes,
it's just water.
Yes. What's it called again? What's it called?
It's the mojito water.
Mojito water.
It has no alcohol. It's just water with mint,
okay,
and lime. And both mint and lime are good for your stomach. They give you this soothing feeling that is very good when you're doing the fast.
Okay, I plan to purchase your book, Dr. Juan. Where would I pick up with this mojito water?
The mojito water is in the book. And,
it's in the book, okay.
It's a recipe that we have in the book. And again, but it's simple. You have to make it's just water. You buy some mint leaves and some lime, and you can prepare it yourself. It's easy to do.
Amen. Amen. Doc, you're giving me weapons to fight with. Your book, is it at Barnes & Nobles? Where can I pick your book up?
You can find it at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and a lot of the bookstores out there.
Doc, thank you so much. God bless you. I've learned something here today. I always learn on Peter's show. And thank you for coming on, Doc. Dr. Warren, you have a blessed day, okay?
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jerry. And you're listening to Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. It's 94 WIP. We're talking with Dr. Juan Rivera, creator of the Mojito Diet. Mojito Diet, a new doctor-designed 14-day weight loss plan with a Miami twist. Mojitos, whoa. Doctor, what's your position on medication as part of a diet plan?
So I've had to use it for some of my patients, Peter. I'm talking about FDA-approved medications for weight loss. There are individuals, Peter, that let's say they have a body mass index of 45 or 50, and they are close to requiring surgery for weight loss. And people might think, oh, my God, surgery, that's extreme. Well, obesity can lead to a heart attack, to diabetes, to a lot of complications. So we need to do whatever we can do to decrease or eliminate that risk factor. So sometimes I have patients that have tried diets for a long time, they exercise, and it's very difficult for them to lose the weight. So in those, I would say 10% of cases, Peter, I do use an FDA medication to try to help them, in combination with the diet, obviously, and exercise.
What about psychotherapy? Because for some people, I think being overweight is a psychological issue as much as a physical one.
You have no idea how important that is, Peter. I'm happy that you mentioned it, because that is one of the things in terms of taking care of patients with overweight or obesity, really, that is missing, the psychological part. I would say that if you're going to gather the A-team, if you will, to treat a patient for obesity and help that patient lose weight, the professionals would be, number one, a doctor with obviously knowledge in weight loss. Number two, a nutritionist. Number three, an exercise physiologist. And usually that's the team that you see. But it is extremely important to have number four there, a psychologist. And hopefully a psychologist that has some experience with weight loss. I think you're absolutely right.
All right. If you're going to form a team, though, how do you find the doctor with the weight loss expertise?
You know, I would say any cardiovascular prevention specialist, which is what I do, they know how to help people lose weight. It's impossible not to, because as cardiovascular prevention doctors, that's a lot of what we do. I would say the most prevalent risk factor for heart disease in our country is obesity. So if patients are coming to you and your job is trying to help them not have a heart attack, then you have to help them to lose weight. So cardiovascular prevention doctors, cardiologists should know how to do that. And there's a lot of internal medicine doctors that have dedicated themselves to the discipline of weight loss. There are some that have specific degrees in terms of that field. So there's a lot of people out there that can help.
Is there a piece of paper or a credential you should look for in the doctor's office when you choose one?
You know, there are some doctors that take certain, you know, courses that relate only to obesity. I'm not sure that that's going to be a diploma. I think that the best way of doing this is you talk to your internal medicine doctor or your cardiologist and you say, "Doc, I need to lose weight. What's the plan?" And if the doctor spends, and this is, I can tell you, I spend probably 20-30 minutes with my patients formulating a plan for weight loss. And then I tell them, I want to see you in 3 or 4 weeks. I want to make sure that I make my patient accountable. If you have a doctor that is taking the time to talk to you about that, if the plan makes sense to you and the plan is clear and they're following up with you regularly, that's a keeper. I think you want to give that doctor a chance.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. We're talking diet, that New Year's resolution that quickly gets broken, with Dr. Juan Rivera, creator of the Mojito Diet. And it's been an enlightening conversation. Doctor, what's the biggest mistake people make when they're trying to lose weight?
You know, I think there are a couple of mistakes, but I would say the biggest mistake is thinking that the only thing that they have to do is eat less. In other words, I used to eat a whole pizza. Now I eat half of that pizza. The problem is that someone who is taking that approach is really not changing the way that they eat. They're still eating pizza every day and burgers and French fries and so forth. You really need to change your food choices to be able to lose weight long term. So I don't like the idea of just cutting your portions. Listen, it's better than nothing. Don't get me wrong. It's better than nothing. But I don't think that that would be ideal. The other mistake people make is forgetting that there are other elements in our life that are going to make us gain weight. For example, people that are sleeping 5 hours a day, they're going to gain weight, and perhaps they don't think about lack of sleep as a risk factor for weight gain. What happens when we don't sleep enough is that there's two hormones that increase in our body. One is called ghrelin, or the hunger hormone, and that hormone makes us extremely hungry. And the other one, it's leptin, which is the hormone that basically tells us, you know what, you're full, stop eating, no more need to eat at this point in time. So leptin goes down, ghrelin goes up when you sleep, let's say, 5 hours a day, and that translates into weight gain.
I have a friend who lost a lot of weight. And one of his tricks was to go from using a dinner plate for meals to a salad plate, because it just cut down the volume he put in there.
Yeah. So as I said, Peter, I think that, you know, I would expect my patients to do more than that. As I said, that's better than nothing. But I think that you still have to make better choices. It's not just eating half a pizza, half a burger, or half a serving of French fries, or half your diet soda. I think you have to change your choices if you want to, number one, lose weight long term, and number two, remember, this is not only about looking good on the outside. This is about decreasing your blood sugar. This is about controlling your blood pressure better. This is about decreasing inflammation in your body, and that's going to come with changing what you eat.
It's about looking good on the inside, too, because as you look at what you got on the outside and it's improving, you can't help but feel better about the inside.
Absolutely. And what I would say, in my experience, Peter, when people set goals that are basically, I want to lose 20 or 30 pounds because I want to wear the jeans that I used to wear when I was 21 years old, I'm not saying they're not going to accomplish it. But in my experience, that is not sustainable. People will gain the weight again. But if you basically think about losing weight as improving your health and living longer and feeling more energetic, those are things that will hopefully incentivize you to change your lifestyle forever.
And that raises another point that I wasn't going to touch, but you sort of hinted at it. People who lose weight and they gain it back and they lose it again and they gain it back and they lose it again, that whole elevator syndrome. What do you do for that?
That's interesting. You call it elevator syndrome, which is the first time I've heard of it. I like it. I'm going to use it from now on. I call it the yo-yo syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, studies have shown that yo-yoing or yo-yo dieting, it's more detrimental to your health metabolically than staying at a weight that it's basically overweight for you consistently. It's interesting. Yo-yo dieting worse than staying overweight, let's say, without changing that much.
Do we know what?
And what I would say, Peter, is that most people that are yo-yoing or going up and down are those that are doing diets that are not easy to follow. They probably eliminate carbohydrates, for example. I mean, take for example, the keto diet, which is popular nowadays. In the keto diet, you're basically eliminating carbohydrates forever. That's our main source of energy. So a lot of people that do the keto diet, yeah, they lose the weight. If you eliminate carbohydrates forever, you're going to lose the weight, but perhaps you're going to feel more tired. So I just don't believe in diets that eliminate a food group forever. And I think those are the individuals that are yo-yoing all the time. They're doing diets that are not reasonable. They're not good in terms of following them forever.
Any last words, Dr. Rivera?
I would say please think about prevention. Preventing disease is extremely important. The time that you invest preventing problems now, that's time that you won't have to invest curing an illness in the future. So prevention, to me, is the most important thing. And diet has to do with that, as well as exercise, sleeping well. There's so many simple things that we can do to prevent health issues. We just got to do it. We have to adopt a lifestyle that focuses on prevention. We have to be proactive and not reactive.
Do you have a website?
I do. People can go to the mojitodiet.com.
Mojitodiet.com. If you want,
and they can, and then they can follow me on social media at Dr. Juan Jr., Dr. Juan Jr.
And I'd like to say thank you to Dr. Juan Rivera for joining us here this morning on Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Thank you, Dr. Rivera. We'll be back after these messages.
Thank you, Peter.
And you've been listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. I want to remind you, it's cold out there and it's snowing out there. It's not too deep yet, but it's a-coming. And no matter where you go, drive carefully and take 94 WIP with you. It's cold. It's snowy. Be safe. And we ease on in out of WIP, the conversation and into WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP as I welcome Tom Shanahan. Tom's new book, Spiritual Adrenaline and a Whole Lot More. Good morning, Tom Shanahan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. What is spiritual adrenaline?
Well, what spiritual adrenaline is, it's a lifestyle that I developed that people who are in addiction recovery can live to try and amplify or really supercharge their traditional drug addiction program, you know, to stay off alcohol, to stay off drugs.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, let me just give you a little background. You know, when I got sober about 8 years ago now, I was going to, you know, 12-step meetings, and there was a lot of positives that came out of that from the point of view of psychologically, but I noticed there was a lot of coffee drinking, lots of cookies, and just general lifestyle. I mean, I smoked back then, and I would take cigarette breaks during meetings. And so, you know, I started to realize that lifestyle that I was living was undercutting my desire to be sober, and it also was, I thought, creating more cravings to use. And so I started going about making minor lifestyle changes to my diet and then exercising more, and I noticed that over time, these small changes started to have really substantial impact on my body and my mind.
Hmm. How? Why?
Well, because, you know, The diet that I was eating early on in recovery was a heavy sugar-based diet. Almost everything I ate the calories came from sugars. I would eat a lot of comfort foods. And what I learned later was that those foods chemically, number one, they prompt the brain to create dopamine, endorphins, and other hormones that are desirable, the feel-good hormones. But they also break down chemically in a manner similar to alcohol in the body because they're glucose. Most of the comfort foods were glucose-based. So what I started to realize was I was spiking my blood sugar up and getting kind of high in a rush and then crashing back down and then replicating that cycle up and down, up and down. And it was very, very similar to how I lived when I was drinking heavily and doing drugs. It's just a constant high, a crash, and then a desire to go back up. And so as I modified the diet in the sense of instead of eating cheap or refined sugars and comfort foods, I started to work in more complex carbohydrates and nutrient-dense foods. I wasn't spiking my blood sugar. I wasn't having, like, a lot of energy and then crashing. I had more sustainable energy over the day. And the reality, too, was as I had the sustainable energy, my mood kind of stayed the same. I wasn't up and down. And cravings seemed to get better for me over time.
One of my favorite television shows is Mom. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
What show? I'm sorry?
Mom.
Mom. No, I have not.
Okay. It's on another network, and it's about a bunch of women who are in recovery. And one woman in particular is a real train wreck sometimes. She's got an alcohol problem. She's had a drug problem. She's got a gambling problem.
Right.
She's got a smoking problem.
Mm-hmm.
She's always finding something new. Multiple addictions really are there, aren't they?
Are you asking my opinion?
Yes.
I'll speak for myself. I think it's very easy to give up one addiction and substitute another addiction for the one that I gave up. Like, for example, when I gave up alcohol and drugs, I started to smoke a lot more than I did when I was actually drinking and using drugs. So I think it's called substitution. I think it's a real thing. And I also think that there's a lifestyle that comes with an addictive personality, which is excess across the board almost in everything we do. That was true for me. And part of getting sober isn't just abstaining from the alcohol or the drugs, right? But starting to recognize those disruptive patterns, and I think a lot of it's genetic. I mean, my family on both sides has a large number of individuals who, whether they admit it or not, have had serious alcohol and or drug problems. So there's a genetic basis to this. And sobriety is really about understanding, after you abstain from the alcohol and the drugs, starting to really understand yourself and trying to manage, like, or trying to recognize when other behaviors either are substituted or become an issue when you remove what the problem was from the past. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think what you're describing is what I've had my friends in 12-step talk about being a dry drunk. You give up the alcohol, but you've still got all the behavior patterns.
That's correct, right.
And moving into something more substantial.
Right, right. Well, you know, can I just add to that? I mean, yes, that's exactly it. And I think that there's a book called Drop the Rock that I read early on in my recovery, and basically that book laid the foundation for my book, which is an actual lifestyle. Drop the Rock spoke to that. It spoke to the large number of people. Then this is, Drop the Rock was written by three authors who had long-term sobriety and had been in the 12-step program for a very long time. But what they were suggesting was a lot of people work step one, which is to surrender, right? But they don't continue on to work the rest of the steps. And steps six and seven specifically speak to the issue of trying to bring balance and take the middle road in your life, and also to recognize the other character defects that can play a role in your addiction, and whether or not you find happiness in sobriety. So what spiritual adrenaline does is, piggybacking on what the authors of Drop the Rock were writing about many, many years ago, it creates a lifestyle that's based upon exercise and nutrition. There's a whole bunch of tools in the book, and they all go right to step six and seven and empower people who maybe have been in long-term sobriety. We call it white knuckling and are unhappy, or maybe they've been happy, but maybe they hit a wall and they want to try something new because they don't feel like they're continuing to make progress. The tools in my book, the exercise and nutrition tools, enable them to give it a try to see if this is something that will work for them.
And you're listening to Conversation moving into WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. We'll be right back with Tom Shanahan, author of Spiritual Adrenaline, in just a bit.
94 WIP FM HD1 Philadelphia, live from the Tasty Cake Studios, your home for Eagles football.
Super Bowl champions!
Streaming at 94WIP.com and the radio.com app. Sports Radio 94WIP, a radio.com station.
And now, the Public Affairs Department of Sports Radio WIP presents Conversations with Peter Solomon, a weekly focus on the issues and people making a difference in Philadelphia and the Delaware Valley. This is Conversations with Peter Solomon.
Out of Conversation and into WIP Sunday here on 94WIP, as we continue with my guest, Tom Shanahan, author of Spiritual Adrenaline and How to Save It. Good morning again, Tom.
And, good morning.
Is it just exercise and nutrition, or is there attitude change as well?
Well, I mean, exercise and nutrition are the underlying tools that I recommend in the book, and that from my own experience and from the experience of each chapter in my book tells the story of someone who followed a similar path. So the exercise and the nutritional tools are the beginning. But I think, and my book is evidence-based, it's science-based, right? So I took a lot of time researching how minor exercise being incorporated into a lifestyle or minor nutritional changes can have large impacts over time. And so if you apply the exercise and the nutrition tools in the way they're laid out in the book, and it's not all of them, you can pick and choose kind of which ones apply to you and which ones you think are appropriate for your own lifestyle, you then start to actually realize, I think is the best way to put it, psychological changes, because you're providing your body, you got to remember, almost all, there's no specific statistic for this, but almost all people who come into recovery are malnourished, okay? There are statistics as to the people who are admitted into inpatient rehabs, okay? Of those people, anywhere, depending on the study that you choose to accept, 65% to 92% of the people who are admitted into inpatient rehabs have either type 2 diabetes or are hypoglycemic. In New York State, because I have those statistics, of the people admitted to inpatient rehab, almost 90% are smoking, okay? So there's a lot of damage done to the body, because even if they're overweight, the people coming in into recovery are oftentimes malnourished, and they haven't really taken care of their body for a long time. So by then providing in recovery your body with the nutrients it needs, number one, to heal, but number two, to function properly. And by starting, you know, there's a saying, move a muscle, change a thought. And by integrating like a lifestyle that includes even minimal exercise, you start to prompt the production of endorphins and dopamine in the brain in a positive way. It makes it easier to get through the day without, you know, without the need for caffeine and lots of sugar to try and keep yourself propped up. And over time, that leads to really substantial changes. And then I also think what leads to substantial psychological change is, you know, there's a lifestyle that comes along with drug addiction and alcoholism, and too often it continues into recovery. You know, that, let's just say, staying up real late at night, watching, laying in bed, not being able to sleep, watching TV, being online, all these different things. And so, you know, by integrating even minimal amounts of exercise and then focusing, trying to get into like the context of group exercise where people, you get to make new associations and new friends, you're changing your view of the world. You're changing the people that you're around and, for example, the times that you're up during the day. And so as you make those changes, I believe, and, you know, the book, each of the chapter inspirations in the book, I think we would tell the same story, that, you know, you're changing your, when you change how you choose to live and the people you choose to surround yourself with, you can change your mindset dramatically. It's the people, places, and things that are dramatically altered by living this lifestyle that leads you to actually enjoy being sober and enjoy waking up in the morning and getting out there and living life.
I think it's true. One place you can find sober people is at an AA meeting. If you're a drinker or a drugger, you're going to be associated with other drinkers and druggers.
That's right. You know, like, I just came back. I was in North Carolina, and then I went to Colorado, and now this week I'm going up to Maine and then up to Rochester. And as part of this is part of the book tour for Spiritual Adrenaline, but it's also visiting gyms that have been either open by or cater to people in the addiction recovery community, because there's this entire movement, Peter, that's happening both in the United States and around the world right now called the Active Sober Movement. And so what these individuals and groups have done, I visited with Res Hope. Res stands for Reservation. That organization was organized by members of the Eastern Band of Cherokee, Caleb McCoy and Caitlin Ledford, down in North Carolina, because the addiction rates on the Cherokee Reservation are double what they are in the general population. And they've created like a healthy, they have a group of people that get up early, they work out in the mornings, they do CrossFit, they go running, you know, so they've really taken like the tools that are in my book, and they've applied them, and they've seen really good results on the reservation. And after I left North Carolina, I went to Pueblo, Colorado. There's an organization there called Addict to Athlete. It's celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. It was founded by Rob and Sheena Archuleta. And what they do is they do very similar to what Res Hope is doing. They have an affiliation with a CrossFit gym there called Stay Invincible CrossFit. And when I was down there visiting with them, you know, they had their regular session. Most of the people, but not all, come in for early morning CrossFit spin classes, and they go for hikes and things like that. And then, but the morning I was there, they also brought in a whole bunch of clients from various rehab facilities around Pueblo. Many of them were like young teenagers, and when they came in, you know, they were to themselves. They were very kind of, you could see they were grumpy. They didn't want to be there. And then after they did like a short meeting and then the CrossFit workout, they were laughing. There was a substantial change in how they were behaving and their attitude, which was observable. It was just so obvious. And so I think the book lays this out. Look, you know, the traditional model has been to address psychological issues, but not, this is when I say the traditional model, I mean for addiction recovery, to address psychological issues, but either not address or leave to the person to address the physical issues. And when I present to people when I go to professional conferences, I talk about, you know, we're not bobbleheads. Our head is attached to our body. So if the body is not being cared for and healthy, it impacts how we think. And so these organizations, you know, the two that I've been to, when I go, the one upstate in upstate New York is called Rockcovery Fitness. It was founded by Yana Casper and Sean Smith. These organizations have had great success in building an active, sober community. And what the statistics show and the research shows, not just from these organizations, but from general peer-reviewed studies that have looked at how this active sober lifestyle impacts relapse rates and cravings, it dramatically lessens them, because the people become part of that community, and then, like, it's a healthy environment for them to be around, and so the benefits to the body carry over into the mind, and I think it makes, the statistics show that makes staying sober easier.
Is there one central place, a website or something we can go to find these kinds of gyms and groups?
Well, that's why I actually wrote the book, and there isn't a centralized website. I have a blog where I promote these organizations. I don't take money from them. I have no financial affiliation with them whatsoever. But I have spent a lot of time researching them. So our website, which is spiritualadrenaline.com, on the recovery exercise page, promotes these organizations and organizations all around the world, actually, now. We have 72,000 Facebook fans on that page. And so we promote all the organizations around the world as we learn about them. And then we also have a Facebook page that is very similar to my website, and we have an active sober community page there where people both can post about their own experiences, and organizations can post about what they're doing to share it with the world. Because with social media, we've been able now to kind of bring people together, whereas in the past, people were isolated wherever they were and really weren't necessarily aware of what other people are doing. And just finally on that note, one of the things that Spiritual Adrenaline, like the organization, is working on is trying to bring together a conference of people who are a part of the active sober movement so that we can talk about, you know, how what they're doing and how what they're doing is impacting people who participate. Because what we believe, and this is a term I really should have used earlier, but in traditional 12-step parlance, exercise and nutrition are called outside issues. But we fundamentally, I believe, and I think the people that I work with, I can speak for them, but I think they would concur, is that outside issues such as nutrition, exercise, they matter. They matter in a big way. So they're not necessarily outside issues.
And I guess my final question, Tom Shanahan, is part of this book, you tell your own story.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I mean, it's private stuff. Why share?
Well, when I first started writing the book, I knew that this had worked for me. And, you know, I started to check my blood from the beginning of when I began living this lifestyle back in 2012 with a doctor. And we still monitor my blood every 3 to 6 months. Not only have my appearance changed and my attitude changed, but my blood work shows an incredible turnaround on my internal health, which I would not have known about unless I had, you know, began working with this doctor in 2012. So I wanted people to really understand this. And this is not, you know, that they can really retake their health. The body can heal. The liver can heal. The kidneys can heal. The lungs can heal. I smoked 24 years, and I just came back from trekking to the Mount Everest base camp in October without a problem. And I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro the year before without a problem. So I want people to understand. That's why I tell my story, that no matter what they've done to their body, the likelihood is they can turn it around. And then I also, you know, share about, people said, well, that worked for you. And that's why I then segue into telling stories in each chapter of other people who have succeeded, because the book is an evidence, science-based approach to physical and mental health. And so what worked for me can work for others. But I think, I also, by the way, I want to say one more thing, Peter. I practice what I preach. And anybody who follows me on Facebook or Instagram or on my website knows that all the tools that are in there are the tools that I used and continue to use. And so I want to share that with people so they know I practice what I preach.
And I'd like to say thank you to my guest this morning, Tom Shanahan, his new book, Spiritual Adrenaline. Judging by Tom's story, it works.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And you're listening to WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. And when we come back after these messages, some good advice for 2019 as we talk with Brian Robinson, author of the new book, Hashtag Chill. Hashtag Chill and a whole lot more after these messages. The WIP time, 7:14. We're back. It's WIP Sunday, and a chilly WIP Sunday it is. Snow on the ground, driving a little treacherous. So be careful. No matter where you go, take us with you. We're good company, hot conversation, and it'll make you slow down and be a little bit more careful. My name's Peter Solomon. 2019, it's just January, but already the year is off to a whiz-bang start. And to help us cope with all that craziness, my next guest, Brian Robinson, author of the new book, Hashtag Chill. Good morning, Brian Robinson.
Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
I'm fine. Hashtag whatever, let alone hashtag chill. Seems like it's overused. What do you think?
The hashtag or
yes,
the chill?
The hashtag.
Oh, well, maybe. But the important point is that folks look at the word chill, and that's why it's in front of it, is because most of us don't pay much attention to it. We're too busy. We're too hurried. We're up to our eyeballs in work or doing. It doesn't have to just be work. It can be whatever your job is, as a mom or stay-at-home dad or a student or whatever, even a retiree are burning out nowadays. So it's really about paying attention to what we call chill, because it's a place within us we can actually go to with a little bit of practice.
All right. Tell me about that place.
Well, it's a place where, you know, we tend to think of chill as kicking back and watching the football game or lying by the pool or getting a massage, and those are great things to do. But it requires a little bit more to really get into that place, and it depends on where our mind goes. We can be exercising or we can be lying by the pool and worried, or our mind can be racing. So it's really about learning to be in the present moment. That's what hashtag chill is really about. And when I'm in the present moment, I'm less likely to snap or react to people who get in my way, like somebody slides into me on the ice, or someone steps in front of me at the grocery store unwittingly. What do I do with that? The key is to pay attention to what's going on inside in the present moment. And as we do that, we notice that we're calmer, we're clearer in our minds, we're more compassionate with ourselves and other people. It's a wonderful place to be in this day and time when we have those kinds of challenges every day, the baby crying on the airplane behind us, the dog barking, the neighbor's weed eater. I don't have to, the people listening right now know exactly what I'm talking about, because they're probably going to have some of these today. So the key is about looking at our knee-jerk reactivity and keeping ourselves as calm as we can when we deal with whatever the nature throws at our way.
But that's hard for a lot of people.
You're damn right it's hard. It's a challenge. But the payoff is worth it. Whenever my reservation for the new year, or resolution for the new year, is to see if I can forgive everybody who gets in the way. And I'm not perfect at it. I wrote the book, and I try to practice what's in the book. They're what I call micro chillers, and these are little 3 to 5 minute things we can do. Sometimes we can do some of these driving to work or driving somewhere in our car. They don't take a lot of extra time, but they really make a difference. But you're right, it's not easy. But you know what? Losing weight and getting my bulk up is not easy either. I have a trainer that I work with, and it took me a long time to be able to bench press my own weight, but I can do it because I wanted to do it, and I've stuck with it, and it makes me feel better. And it's the same with our mental process. I'm in charge of what I think and how I behave. I don't have to let every little thing that comes my way push a button inside me. Then I have no control over my life, and I'm miserable.
If I understand you right, the only person who can push your buttons is you.
Exactly. Or not. I mean, I have a choice that I can allow that moment, in that moment, something to do it or not. And sometimes I do get my buttons pressed, because you know why? I'm human. Everybody listening is human. So it's not about being perfect. It's about having the intention and doing the best you can. We're all human beings. I stepped in line in front of people. I did it at the post office last week. I didn't realize I was doing it. I get in people's way. So it's not about just people getting my way. It's about forgiving people who do and forgiving myself when I do it. And if we could all do that, gosh, what a world would it be? I know it's a tall order. It's a bitter pill to swallow, but it's fun. If you look at it as kind of a challenge and an activity or an experiment, you can have fun with it and see how you can do. But when you are successful, it's like you've made a touchdown or a home run. It's a great feeling when you're in charge of yourself.
How do you do it? I mean, give me an example of a micro chiller.
Well, I could give you many, but I was getting off the freeway not too long ago, and I looked over, and a woman who had been in front of me gave me the finger, and I was shocked. I didn't know why, and I still don't know why. Now, I could have focused on her. I could have rolled the window down and given her the same gesture and yelled some obscenities, but what I try to do is look inside myself at that part of me. It's not me, but my anger. That's what my anger wanted me to do, but I'm not my anger. I'm me. So a chiller would be when someone triggers you is to watch your thoughts and feelings and see if you can be in charge of them instead of them being in charge of you. That's one. Let me give you another one. I recommend that people make a to-be list. We all know about to-do lists. What would be on your to-be list? So you bring that in to give a little more balance to the doing. Being and doing bring the balance. Another example would be if I ask you, Phil, what are your tall comings? Well, there's no such word. I made that word up. But we all know about our shortcomings, right? And they're so easy to roll off. Mother Nature wired us with what scientists call a negativity bias. And what that means is I'm more likely to look at life through a negative lens than a positive lens. The reason is for survival, but that's my survival brain or my reptilian brain. Do I want to live my life from my reptilian brain reacting to everything around me? No, I don't. Some people can if that's what they choose to do. But if you want to live longer, and there's science behind all this, if you want to be happier, if you want to feel good about yourself in your skin, and if you want to produce good results of whatever your work is that you feel good about, then you want to go beyond your survival, because that's simply just to keep us alive. I want to do more than exist. I want to live fully. And to live fully, to have work-life balance, it requires us to put a little bit more effort into it. Oh, by the way, the tall comings, which I was mentioning, are just you just flip the shortcomings. What are the things you're good at? What are your good qualities that people say? And what that does, it brings, again, balance to the negativity bias that we have in our culture.
Well, it's interesting to me, though, Brian, because sometimes when someone gives you the finger, it's kind of emotionally satisfying to give them the finger back.
Well, it wouldn't be for me because I would feel like I was reacting instead of acting. And what I try to do is act, because when I act, but not only do I feel better inside, but I don't have the boomerang of the adrenaline and the cortisol that clogs my arteries and makes me feel bad. So we talk about, in my book, I talk about the first and second zinger. And this also is from thousands of years of study and science. The first zinger is the woman who gives me the finger, or the person who cuts me off in traffic. That's not where my suffering comes from. My disappointment or misery comes from the second zinger. That's the zinger I throw at myself when I react. When I'm not in charge, when I try to control things that I can't control, it's useless. It's frustrating. It adds more fuel to the fire. So what we know is when we can act instead of react, stay in that chill place, not only do we feel better, but physiologically we're going to live longer, actually. We're going to have a clearer mind. We're going to have more confidence in ourselves. We're going to have more curiosity instead of judgment. There are 8 C words that go with the chill place, that sweet spot that we're able to find over time. And it's calm, courage, connectedness with ourselves and other people, confidence, curiosity. What am I forgetting here? Creativity. So there are 8 of them. I'm not sure I hit them all, but and of course, compassion, self-compassion, as well as compassion for others.
How'd you get so smart?
Oh, hard knocks. You know, my philosophy, and this later in my life, you know, in my adulthood, I realized that it's futile to try to control life's curveballs. It only makes me more miserable. It makes me want to overwork or drink too much, or it leads us into addiction. So my philosophy, and I borrowed this from John F. Kennedy, is ask not how life is treating you, ask how you're treating life. And if, again, it's a flip. It brings the balance. If I can do that on a daily basis, how am I treating what just happened, either the person who got in my way or pissed me off or the situation? If I ask myself on a daily basis, how am I treating what life is bringing to me, it's going to help me change my whole life. It's amazing how that happens. Because life is not going to gear itself to Phil or Brian. Life is not personal. Life is just going to be. So it's up to me to take it and make it do the best I can with it. And so that's really what the book's about, is how you can take things you can't control, life, when it brings us all kinds of challenges, and turn it into something that works for you. You're going to feel better. You're going to feel more empowered. You're going to be more successful in whatever you're trying to accomplish, and you're going to live longer. We know from the research, we have the technology now. We have MRIs that show that people who take 5 minutes a day, and this is my, again, what I talk about in the book, to meditate, to go inside, to contemplate, to pray, whatever your thing is, I meditate for 5 minutes every day. It will change your life. It will change how you look at what's happening to you. It will help you handle it in a way you feel good about. 5 minutes a day, and everybody has 5 minutes from sunrise to sunset somewhere. Used to be I would suggest that hands would go up and folks say, oh, I don't have time for that, I'm too busy, I got too much to do already, I can't add to it. This is not about adding to it. It's about you can do this while you're on your way to something, driving your car, as long as you're not meditating, or sitting in your office or at home. You can do it anywhere. So it's just about finding that sweet spot and going there. What it does from the MRIs that we know is it improves brain functioning. The hippocampus, which is responsible for memory, does not shrink as much as you get older if you meditate 5 minutes a day, or if you do some kind of chill 5 minutes a day. We notice that, and what that means is you don't lose your memory as you get older. We also know that it raises your immune system. It helps with heart rate. You don't have you're less likely to have a heart attack. So there are just so many benefits that we're seeing. We can actually see it in the brain.
All important stuff, certainly. You are an incredibly productive human being, though. I mean,
yep.
You teach.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a private practice.
I do.
And you write. I mean, the list of books you've published, fiction and nonfiction, is astounding to me. I mean, I don't know a whole lot of people who have their own page in Wikipedia.
Yeah.
How do you get it all done?
Well, in the throes of my own work addiction, some of the books, the early books that I wrote, were an outcome of that. I'm different now, and let me just explain what I mean by that. I'm still productive. And this is an important point you're bringing up, Phil, because people who are in chill can be very productive, actually more productive. We know that when you're in chill, not only are you're going to move a little slower, you're going to be more productive, you're going to feel better, and the outcome is going to be higher quality. And that's from the research that's coming out. So The way I describe the difference, and by the way, I have another novel coming out. I'm working on another book. I have my practice. I don't teach at the university anymore. I'm a professor emeritus there, but I teach in other ways, in a more global way. But I'm drawn instead of driven. It used to be I was driven, which means I was rushing to meet someone else's deadline. I was hurrying, and my heart was, I was starting to have heart problems. And now I'm drawn, which means I'm in charge, and I drive the car. I don't let it drive me. I come from that chill place, which is a center inside me that I've learned to go into so that I'm calmer and I'm clearer about my decisions and which way I want to go. I'm less frustrated. I react less. That's why I was able to not react to the woman who gave me the finger, because I was able to look inside and let me handle that instead of my anger. And so the difference is we can be driven by external circumstances, by what people are demanding of us, or we can be drawn from our truth and be true to ourselves.
What happened, though, to give you that insight? I mean, you said you were an earlier driven person. How'd you become drawn?
Right. That's a good question. Well, a lot of things, one of which was a family member went into treatment for alcoholism, and I went along to help him for his problem, and in the process realized I had something just as bad, if not worse, which was work addiction, working around the clock. I was having physical problems. I was losing my memory. All I did was work, and I had no relationships, no friends. And once I started to realize that, I went into Workaholics Anonymous, which is similar to Alcoholics Anonymous. But the thing that really helped me get out of that fog was the what we call mindfulness meditation. That's taking that time out, and I call it chill. It's my version of taking time out from the rat race, just like putting on the brakes when you're going 90 miles an hour. If you don't have brakes, you're going to die. So we have to have brakes. My body is my vehicle that gets me where I need to go. And when I was driven, I had the gas pedal to the floor. There were no brakes. Now I have brakes, and I've learned to do that. And I've learned in the process, I'm happier, I'm more productive, I continue to be productive, but I don't feel the anxiety or the pressure or the stress of it because I'm in that sweet spot. So it was being in the present moment, learning to be mindful of what's happening right now instead of my head being in the future, worried about how am I going to meet the deadline, or regretting the past, how I treated someone because I wasn't present with them. And when you're in the present moment, there is no problem really. And it slows down your heart rate, loosens your muscles. It's kind of like getting ready for the Olympics, and then you go back into the game, and your batteries have been recharged. And the vehicle, your body, that's taking you where you need to go and helping you out, is going to appreciate it. It's going to be healthier.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest, Dr. Brian Robinson, Ph.D., author, academic, new book, Chill. We'll be back in just a bit. Stay with me, please, Brian Robinson. The WIP time, 7:37. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday into the home stretch with Dr. Brian Robinson, psychotherapist, Ph.D., author, former academic, and a whole lot more. His new book, Hashtag Chill. Doctor, you talked about mindfulness, being in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
How do you meditate with all those other voices in your head? I mean, you know, you're thinking about what you got to do when you get to work. You're thinking about the patient. You're thinking about what your partner wants from you, all those things.
Yeah, that is the best question I think anybody could ask because it implies it's a question a lot of people ask, and a lot of people have a misunderstanding of what meditation is. Meditation is about focus. And a lot of people sit down and they try to clear their mind. That's the worst thing you can do. It's also impossible because you can't clear your mind. The key is to focus. And there are many types of meditation. A guided imagery is where you listen to someone guiding you through it and you focus on what they tell you to focus on. That's one type. What I do is I focus on my breath. And here's how that works. I focus on my breath as I breathe in through my nose and out through my mouth. And then here's what happens. My mind will start to wander. I gently bring it back. What people don't understand is when your mind wanders about the kind of things you were just mentioning, that's part of meditation. So you just gently bring it back. Don't get frustrated. Just, you know, stay with it. It's going to wander again. You just bring your mind back and focus on your breath, in through your nose, out through your mouth. It's going to wander again. So the key is focus. And if you do that, after a while you start to notice. When I say after a while, I mean maybe a week or 2 weeks. It's just like losing weight or working out. You start to notice your muscles are getting a little tighter, and you start to notice you're not as reactive automatically. So clearing your mind is an outcome or a byproduct of focus. It's not a goal. You don't try to do it. That'll backfire on you. So you have to just let, when your mind wanders, remember that's part of what meditation is, because what you're doing is you're training your mind to stay in the present moment. And you're right, it is going to go to, you know, how am I going to get this done? What is the boss going to like what I'm doing? Is my spouse going to be pleased with me or upset with me? Those are thoughts we all have. But that means that your thoughts are in charge of you. The whole goal in being in that sweet spot of chill is that you're in charge of your thoughts. So that's where your power comes from. So it takes a little time to get there, but if folks listening would do it 5 minutes a day, they will start to notice a shift, that they're a little more in charge of their thoughts and their emotions, and they're not being led around by the nose, by what they think and what they feel. It's a powerful thing. Another example, this is really easy, Phil, is if everybody listening, after I'm off the air, take, let's say, 2 minutes and just listen to every sound they can identify in 2 minutes. Just sit and just focus. It could be their gurgling stomach. It could be the heating system. It could be traffic outside or an airplane going over or somebody's voice off in the distance. And after 2 minutes, notice, if you just focus on every sound you're aware of, and your mind might wander a little bit, that's okay, just let it be okay, you will notice that your heart rate slows down, your breathing slows down a little bit, your muscles loosen some. It's amazing. Now, when you do that over time, your brain learns, hey, I can have brakes and gas. I don't have to have the pedal to the metal all the time.
You write about and talk about being chill at work. How do you be chill at work without getting fired?
Well, sometimes not being chill at work will get you fired. When you're chill at work, it just means you're calm and you're clear and you have compassion. You're taking good care of yourself, which means you're going to navigate those obstacles. You had a commercial earlier that I loved. It said obstacles can become openings. And that is so true. An obstacle can be a challenge, and we can navigate that, scale the wall of that obstacle in calm ways. It doesn't have to be stress. But again, if you're in that chill spot, it's like if you go to the Olympics, if somebody goes to the Olympics, they don't just show up. They get ready for it. And so when you're, let's say, meditating 5 minutes a day, you're getting ready for those things at work that are going to be challenges, and you're more likely to overcome them. If you think of some of the people we all know, like LeBron James or Meryl Streep or Michael Phelps or Serena Williams, each one has their own expertise, and they're very talented, and they got there through a lot of sweat and tears. But they have more than just that, the skill of what it is that they do. They know how to concentrate. They know how to deal with the thoughts that say, I can't do it. They didn't just get there automatically. It was a zigzag line. So whatever folks that are listening, whatever they're trying to accomplish, it's not just having the talent and the physical skill, it's also having the mindset that will help you navigate to get there. That's really important. When you have a million people looking at you and you're playing basketball or golf or tennis or acting, you've got to have your mind in the right place or you'll never make it. And you're going to fail. You cannot be successful without failure. Life has bookends. Every up has a down. Every right has a left. It's the way life is. You cannot be successful without some kind of defeat. But you're not defeated until you quit. Defeat, these people that I'm naming, and there are hundreds of others we could name, Lady Gaga is another one, they don't get there through success. They get there by falling down, picking themselves up, brushing themselves off, taking the towel they want to throw in and wiping the sweat off their brow, and they keep on going. That's why they succeed. That's why I've succeeded in the little bit of things that I've done. I've had lots of rejection. I've had lots of obstacles, but those things don't get in my way. They do get in my way, but they're openings, like your commercial said. They're not closings.
With all the things you've written, I'm sure there have been a few rejection slips over the years.
Oh, goodness, yes. And I didn't hear your question, though. What was your question?
I'm sure there's been a whole bunch of rejection slips over the years.
How'd you believe it.
How'd you get past them? I mean, I would imagine the temptation to say, okay, that's it, throw it away.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there was a time when I actually even did that. Yeah, when I tried to write my first novel, which is really different from writing nonfiction, writing fiction requires you to show instead of tell. And, oh, I got tons of rejections. I bet I got 80 rejections. But you know what I found out? I'm not alone. J.K. Rowling, who, you know, everybody knows who J.K. Rowling is, had hundreds of rejections. And now she's a I think she's a billionaire now.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen King talks about his 20, 30 rejections that he got before he got his first acceptance. I have learned to deal with rejection. I've learned to deal with, because I know rejection is not final. That's the key, or failure is not final. We have, in psychology, we have something called the growth mindset, and what that means is if you look at failure or rejection as fodder, you turn it inside out and make it work for you. It can actually help you get to where you want to go. You don't look at it as final. You look at it as something that's inevitable on the road to success. Everybody's going to fail. That is not final unless you quit. It doesn't have to be final. So it's an attitude of success. It's the winning frame of mind is what I call it. And everybody has it. Grass grows through concrete. Think about that. You see it in nature. Grass grows through concrete. Everybody listening has within them a resilient zone that is stronger than the obstacles that come to them. A lot of people don't know that because they haven't kept going. But if you keep on going, you're going to get where you want to go. It might not be the way you envision it, but you'll get there if you don't give up.
Finally, how do you want people to use hashtag chill?
Well, I'd like for them to use it in small steps, you know, as because it requires change. Change doesn't come overnight. It's a slow process, like the seasons that change. But take it one step at a time and get a copy of the book and go on my website, because there's a test you can take that asks you how chill you are. That's a good beginning point, is to figure out how chill you are. It's BrianRobinsonBooks.com. It's B-R-Y-A-N, RobinsonBooks.com. The test is free. It gives you an immediate electronic score. There are blogs from Psychology Today that I write on there, and there's a lot of other free information that can help you get started and give you kind of a roadmap to guide you along the way.
And certainly, hashtag chill, available through Amazon and Barnes Noble. Thank you, Dr. Brian Robinson.
Thank you, Peter.
My pleasure. And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's snowing out there, and it's probably going to keep snowing for a while. The roads are slick. Be careful, please. I want you all back here next Sunday for more conversation, more WIP Sunday. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sonny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your opinions, Sonny's reactions, I know I'll be listening. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and to Ann Tideman-Solomon, associate producer, and my dear wife. Couldn't do it without you. Finally, there's nothing left to say, but stay warm, stay safe. See you soon.